Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. We are back with you today with another installment of our Talking Markets podcast series, where we do like to catch up with industry colleagues and partners to hear their thoughts on a range of market and macro topics, as well as spend some time on portfolio positioning. So joining me here for the conversation today, glad to welcome back Dan Suzuki, Deputy Chief Investment Officer with Richard Bernstein Advisors, or RBA. Dan, it's great to have you back. I know you were last on with us in late October of last year, so a lot has taken place since then, which gives us a lot to talk about today.
Yeah, I'm always fun to be back on the show, and there's a lot going on, so hopefully we can fit it all in.
Yeah, it's great to have you back, Dan. So maybe let's begin with the U.S. economy. I know we're making our way through the late innings, so to speak, of Q1. We're coming off a recent employment report. We had some notable inflation data this week. So how would you characterize the health of the U.S. economy as it stands today? And can you speak a bit to your outlook for the economy's trajectory in 2025?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, the way we laid it out going into this year was this was going to be 2025 was going to be a year of two halves. And so, or not even halves, really Act One and Act Two. And, you know, the thesis was that Act One was going to be a very healthy economy with accelerating corporate profits. And later in the year, we were going to morph into Act Two, which was a slowing economy and slowing corporate profits. I think that's still the case. And the timing is really going to be sort of the key question here of when you make that transition to Act Two. So, you know, as I look at the economy today, Dan, I think the economy is actually quite healthy, contrary to popular belief. Most of the hard data has been coming in pretty strong. So when you look at people's indications of spending and retail sales, and we just got the jobless claims numbers this week, most measures of hard data are actually pretty good. People are worried about slowdown, worried about the economy. I'm starting to see more articles talking about recession. I think what that's pointing to is the soft data. So whether it's the survey data like consumer sentiment, ISM, a lot of different surveys, including the NFIB, which we got this week, a small business survey, and including company guidance as well, that's really where you've seen people take their expectations down. And I think that's directly related to policy uncertainty. So, you know, at very high level, hard data, the actual growth story is pretty decent. The expectations, people are starting to get worried about that. And I do think, to be fair, that we are at the trend point where, you know, some of those the fear and expectations is starting to seep into, you know, people's spending decision making today. So the longer that this goes on, the more you'll actually start to see the weakness bleed into the hard data. And so that's definitely a concern and could bring forward, you know, the transition into Act Two that we were expecting to be a little bit later this year. So I think that's the key issue is when are we going to get to that slowdown period?
So, Dan, as we're speaking today on Thursday, March 13th, I'm sure our listeners have taken notice of the turbulence in the markets over the past few sessions. You can tie to that, as you alluded to, fears over a recession, growth concerns. On top of that, you also have a very fluid tariff environment with respect to U.S. trade policy, and that has indeed resulted in some investor angst. So how do you anticipate, Dan, that the trade environment might evolve from here? I know it's very fluid. And what do markets really need to see in order to find a bit of footing?
Yeah, I think, you know, the first part of the question, I mean, who knows, right? I mean, it is a crazy time right now. And I think you're probably better suited with a degree in psychology than you are a degree in economics to really parse through what's actually going to happen. But ultimately, I think, you know, the U.S. negotiators and President Trump are operating on, you know, two key assumptions that are driving everything. I think, you know, first off, I think is the assumption that, you know, they need us more than we need them. And you can see that based on sort of import-export impact relative to the overall economy. U.S. is relatively insulated relative to other countries. And then the second assumption is that, the cost of fighting back against our demands is a lot higher than the cost of actually making some of those concessions, in which case I think that sets the stage for an eventual deal where people will make other countries will make concessions, you know. But I think probably we're in this period, at least for the next, you know, 3 to 4 weeks, where it's not going to feel like we have any certainty around the conclusion. So I think that's the issue for markets, because at the end of the day, markets don't really, you know, investors don't really care too much about good policy or bad policy. What they do crave is certainty and clarity around policy. And that's something that's, you know, obviously very lacking today. So any moves to increase certainty and clarity, I think will be beneficial to the markets. But I think we're in for a period, you know, that could last for this administration where, you know, overall policy uncertainty is elevated. And what you're starting to see being reflected in markets is that there's an uncertainty premium, you know, baked in, and that's directly affecting valuation. So if you were to just draw a chart of, you know, how much different parts of the market and different stocks went down relative to their initial valuations, you'd see that there's an extremely strong correlation with that. And that's almost tells you that there's a valuation discount being put into play as a result of this uncertainty. And so I think what do markets need to see some footing? Ultimately, they'd like to see some at least some clarity on particularly the key moving parts on the Trump policy agenda.
So outside of trade policy, which carries with it perhaps some prolonged uncertainty, as you suggested, Dan, if we look at the policy landscape, what might be some other economic policy or legislative priorities of the Trump administration, a Congress that you're monitoring at the moment?
Yeah, Dan, our sort of general view on all this stuff is that profits drive markets, not politics. So we tend to sort of discount a lot of the major policy headlines unless, you know, those policies are really going to have a direct impact on profits. And now, clearly, if we have, you know, ongoing tariffs, that's going to impact profits. And so that's why that's a key issue for markets. When you look at the top of, you know, the Trump administration's agenda, they're looking at immigration, regulation, taxes, and trade, to name a few. And I think for most of those, and ending the war in Ukraine, I think most of those have a somewhat limited, you know, impact on profits outside of trade, which we talked about. The one that could have a clearly a direct impact on profits is going to be corporate taxes. But there, you know, I think we've made the big moves on corporate taxes during the last Trump administration. You know, I think, you know, we brought it from a 35 to a 21% corporate tax. That's a huge jump. Now, you know, if we go from a 21% to a 20% or an 18%, I think that's just a smaller impact. And it is more difficult to get done. So I think that ultimately, you know, from here, once we get beyond trade, it's really going to be more about headline risk. But I think that ultimately what's happening in the rest of the economy, regardless of the Trump administration's policy, is going to be a bigger factor.
So if we spend a few moments on the Fed, Dan, it was interesting. I did see following that CPI print yesterday, some headlines suggesting that that perhaps gives the Fed some incentive to lower rates. I don't know about that. But if we look forward through the balance of this year, what are your expectations for monetary policy?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm of the view that the Fed is, and I've said this before probably on your show, Dan, that the Fed is a lagging indicator, you know, managing to lagging indicators. So I think that if you want to understand where Fed policy is going to go, it's ultimately going to be a function of growth, because growth is eventually going to drive inflation and policy is going to, you know, follow inflation. So, you know, as I said, you know, in the near term, we're a little bit more optimistic on growth. I think it's going to hold up more than people think in the near term. So I think, you know, that leads us to sort of take the over on the near term outlook for Fed policy, which means, you know, less cuts or later cuts than what the market's pricing in the near term. But then again, as we transition to that sort of slowing act two of the play, I think the likelihood for cuts goes up a lot. And so there, as we approach toward the end of the year, you maybe want to take the under, you know, on where our Fed rates are going to be. So I think it's going to be sort of fluid, you know, based on when we make that transition to act two.
Jumping around a bit to investment themes, artificial intelligence, AI continues to be a top theme of our UBS Chief Investment Office. And we certainly have seen some disruption in this space over the past couple of months. So I'm curious how you at RBA are thinking about AI, the role it plays in an economy, and where you see opportunities in this space right now, Dan.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it's an amazing time to be alive, right? I mean, sure. Forget the investment side for a second, but the amount of innovation that we're seeing is staggering. And you know, it's changing our lives and, you know, constantly changing the mix of the economy. So it's certainly an exciting time. I think when we talk about markets, we have to remember that, you know, capitalism is really based on, you know, innovation and disruption, right? So, you know, there's this idea out there, we've had this disruption from AI and AI-related companies, but there's also this sort of embedded view that these disruptors cannot themselves be disrupted. And so I think when people invest in these, you know, exciting innovation themes, whether it's the internet back in the 2000s, 3D printing, you know, weight loss drugs, solar, electronic vehicles, you know, you go through every single one of these cycles, you know, there's a couple of takeaways. I mean, one, as an investment, you know, the time when people are most excited about them and valuations get really high, the investment turns out to not be that well. And why is that the case? Well, one, I think the market tends to price in anything related to those themes as big winners when it's actually select few, and very oftentimes it's not the ones that people are expecting to be the winners. Like in the internet, in 1999, 2000, if you were bullish on the internet, maybe you would have said, well, I got to own AOL.com and Friendster. Right. Not knowing that it was going to be, you know, Meta, Facebook or Meta and Google and Amazon, which was a bookstore at the time. Right. So I think the emerging winners, you know, are oftentimes not the ones that, you know, are the obvious plays. And so I think that's the critical thing. And what we learned in the last few weeks with respect to sort of innovation and disruption is, you know, there's oftentimes, you know, after the initial innovation, there's a lot of competition that comes into play. They do things cheaper, they do things better and faster, and that's how some of the early leaders can be disrupted. And that's just a matter of time. Whether or not it's DeepSeek or some other company is sort of secondary to the point that that's just inevitable. You've seen it already with sort of the weight loss drugs, you know, and you've seen it all across all these innovations we spoke about.
Well, the rapid evolution of this space is quite fascinating. So before we close out, Dan, just accounting for everything you've covered with us today, spanning economic conditions to the policy environment, what is your overall investment outlook from here? And where are you finding opportunities? Where are you putting money to work at the moment?
Yeah, I think, Dan, it really it comes back to sort of that initial framework that I laid out, which was sort of the Act One, Act Two. You know, Act One, I'm pretty optimistic on profits. I think that profit growth is still accelerating in the U.S. And it's, and not only is it accelerating, but it's continuing to broaden out. I mean, if you just look up, we kind of wrapped up fourth quarter earnings season. This is the most sectors, breadth of sectors that you've seen with positive earnings growth in several years now. And I think that's going to continue. So the broadening out of earnings growth means, you know, that this initial broadening out of leadership in the market should continue. And so that's where I want to own, is the areas where, you know, the fundamentals are broadening out to, and therefore the markets will likely broaden out to. So in the near term during Act One, I think that broadening is toward sort of expensive and crowded cyclicals, like, you know, dirty old boring cyclicals like industrials or financials, small caps, I think eventually will start to get a bid as things accelerate. I think those are some of the near-term opportunities. But again, you know, around the corner and potentially brought forward by some of this tariff uncertainty is that Act Two, an environment where profits growth are slowing. I think, you know, in that environment, you really want to think about, you know, the scarcity in tomorrow's market or today's market even may increasingly be clarity and certainty. So who are the companies that are going to provide that for you? The more defensive, less cyclical companies with stable cash flows. I think those are the areas that will eventually be, you know, the underappreciated opportunity as volatility picks up potentially in the second half of the year.
Dan, very productive, wide-ranging, and actionable conversation. It would be great to revisit this in a few months. We'll see how some of these items play out from here. Will give us a lot to talk about, I'm sure. Though, Dan, it was great catching up with you today. Thank you for dropping by.
Yeah, thanks. Love to come back.
Absolutely. Thanks,
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.